Let's begin this morning with a double text, one from Scripture, one from an American novelist. Thomas Wolfe said something in one of his letters that explains what many of us look for in religion. He said, "I think we never lose entirely the hope that we have in childhood and that persists strongly in the first years of our youth, that we will meet someone of such invincible strength and wisdom and experience that all the grief and error in our own lives will be resolved by that person." Literary critics and psychologists interpret Wolfe's words as the search for a father image, a search doomed to failure because no other human being can be and do all those things. People who end up in cults think they have found such a person, and they follow to Jonestown and Waco. Jesus made no bones about warning his own disciples against such mistakes. Near the close of the famous Sermon on the Mount, he admitted that there would be false religious teachers. "You may know them," he said, "by what they actually do. It is not everyone who keeps saying to me, 'Lord, Lord,' who will enter the kingdom of heaven, but those who actually do the will of God." This is such an interesting comment that we need to reflect on it for a moment. It says bluntly that some people who seem extremely religious, who are forever tossing around the name of the Lord, may not be genuine at all. You can talk the talk, Jesus says, and never be anywhere close to true religion. You can say the name, even with great reverence, and do all sorts of things in that name, and still hear this judgment, "I never knew you." We've been talking about religion for several weeks, and one thing said last week was that religion must be an adventure. Even when it carries the risks and dangers of all genuine adventure. I wasn't taught this as a child, as some of you were not. We were told that we should guard the faith as if it were something delicate and vulnerable. What my preacher really meant was that I was to guard our system of interpretations, our creed, against anyone who might challenge or change it. We were to guard it even against our own curiosity, so that if we ask a controversial question in a class, we were reminded firmly that questioning can be a form of disbelief. Religion, for my first teachers, was a title deed to be locked up in a safe of orthodoxy. It was not a living thing. It did not wiggle or change or grow. Their system kept them from understanding that faith is not an anchor, but a hoisted sail. That it's not the ship in the harbor, safe from wind and waves, but the ship on the open sea, facing whatever comes. If the Christian church had not forgotten this, so often during its 2,000-year history, we would have been spared most of those sometimes silly, sometimes ugly quarrels between science and religion. Early Christians, including the Apostle Paul, were quite sure that the world would come to an end in their lifetime. Their more scientific neighbors said, probably not. It's been around for a long time. It will likely last a long time yet. Well, they turned out to be right. And the church had to adjust its faith to make room for the 19 more centuries that have come and gone since. In the 16th century, the church was horrified when science said that instead of being the center of the universe, the earth we live on is a minor planet revolving around a minor star in a universe so vast it staggers the imagination. But this contradicted the way the church read the story of creation. And so Galileo was condemned as a heretic. Only recently did the church that condemned him confess publicly that it was wrong and he was right. It was the thing to do, but it was painfully slow in coming. 350 years. We have known for that long that Galileo was right, and a confession as tardy as that one does not help religion's standing with intelligent people. Even as recently as 100 years ago, the church in general was positive that the earth was only 6,000 years old. And when science provided evidence that it had been around for hundreds of millions of years, the church thought faith and the Bible had both been destroyed, and they refused to give an inch until the evidence became so overwhelming that once again the church had to back away, accept the scientific view, and fit it into its system. This pattern of outrage and warfare, followed almost inevitably by surrender, has not served religion very well. When Charles Darwin and others gave massive evidence for the theory of evolution, the church again rejected it until the data convinced millions of Christians that the theory was true and that Genesis could, after all, be read in a way that allowed for it. One reason the church has kept on fighting the discoveries of science is that pulpit preachers have often been afraid to close the gap between what they were taught in seminaries and what their listeners knew. Capable professors in seminaries all around the country have been unafraid for years to discuss what inspiration means, how the Bible was composed, how much of it was influenced by the culture around it, what comparative religious studies can teach us about many biblical laws and customs. And they can do this in seminaries free from rigorous denominational control because they are committed to truth more than they are committed to doctrine or tradition. But when their students go out to local congregations to preach, they quickly find out that some in their audience do not wish to hear anything new or different, and do not intend that anyone else shall hear it. I remember thinking in my first church that it might be exciting to teach the book of Ecclesiastes in a Wednesday evening Bible class. Three elders governed that church, and one of them, I recall fondly, was a joy to be with socially or to go out with on a quail hunt. He had very little formal education, but he was warm and loving and happy-go-lucky, and a young minister and his wife ate some of the best quail dinners in the world at that man's house. But I had barely gotten into Ecclesiastes, which is a very realistic and generally pessimistic book, when this man threw up his hands and said, "I didn't know the Bible had anything like that in it, and it upsets me. I don't want to hear it. Let's drop this book and go on to something else." Well, he was what we called the bull elder. The real power in that church. So we dropped it. Religion was not adventure for this good man. He liked adventure in his work and in his recreation, but not in his religious life. Pearl Buck wrote an article years ago about what religion meant to her. And among other things, she spoke of not getting much from pulpits whenever she visited. One preacher she had gotten to know outside the pulpit struck her as decently curious and open and good to talk with until she went to hear him preach. And after his sermon, she says, "I accused him of this odd change that took place in him on Sunday morning. And he said, that is the effect of the people in the pew. I know they are listening sharply to hear if what I say is what they want to hear. I have to pay heed to them, because if they hear that with which they cannot agree, they cut down on their giving. I might endure that for myself and even for my family, but there is the whole work of the church to suffer, both home and foreign missions. There are many persons besides myself involved." You wonder how a man like this could ever think of his life and his religion as an adventure, ever get excited about some new discovery, some new insight, so much so that he had to share it, even if it did disturb his listeners and force them to think. When Archimedes jumped out of his bath and ran around the streets yelling, "Eureka!" Why did that happen? Well, he was having one of the most thrilling experiences in human life. He had tried an experiment, something new. The universe had responded positively, and he knew that he was dealing with reality, with new and exciting truth. When Newton found out that the movements of the heavenly bodies could be brought together under a single law, and that his figures were working out correctly, he fell into such intense agitation that he couldn't go on with his calculations and had to get a friend to finish for him. Religious leaders will have that excitement too from time to time if they are following truth instead of guarding tradition. And sadly, if church audiences miss that kind of excitement, it's not because they are not intelligent. It's because those they count on to share their insights are fearful.